It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The National Catholic Center for Holocaust Education at Seton Hill University is holding a conference next week designed to explore the untold stories of Jews killed and buried in mass graves throughout the Soviet Union during World War II. New methods of detection and the use of sensor equipment are helping researchers find countless mass graves. I'm joined now in studio by Tim Crane, director of the center. Tim Crane, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
What inspired your interest in the hidden Holocaust?
Well, from the standpoint in terms of as a modern Jewish historian who's also Roman Catholic, to me, the mass murder of the European Jews made very little sense that it took place, quite frankly, because it's something that certainly should not have. But the more I got into and more interested I became, when we think about the Holocaust, we see it more so from the standpoint of the gas chambers and the death camps that operated exclusively in Poland in the backdrop of the Second World War. And those corpses, overwhelmingly, the victims there, unfortunately, were not only killed, but they were also, their bodies were incinerated. And from the standpoint, what sets the hidden Holocaust apart is the fact that the first major victims of the Holocaust were Soviet Jews. They were the beginning of the Aktion, as the Germans referred to it as, was with the onset of Operation Barbarossa in the summer of 1941. And you have hundreds of thousands, eventually now well over a million. The estimates are going to go as high as about 2.3 million Soviet Jews who were shot summarily and buried in these mass graves across all different parts of the Soviet Union, as well as different areas as well in Eastern Europe.
And explain why this happened to the Soviet Jews, because though there was a treaty which essentially sealed Poland's fate, mm-hmm. between Stalin and Hitler, there was an about-face by the Russians. They joined the Allies. They were fighting the Germans. So mm-hmm. why was it that the Soviet Jews were getting killed? Was it by the Germans coming through the Soviet Union, or what happened there?
Heading into the Second World War, Adolf Hitler actually saw himself as fighting two distinct wars, a war against the Allies, for which he had the German Wehrmacht, and by the same token, a war against the Jews. For his war against the Jews, he had the SS as well as the Einsatzgruppen that would carry out in terms of the mass murder. So when he invades the Soviet Union, really the Holocaust starts then on June 22nd, 1941. And the Germans would search for a more efficient way of dealing with this Jewish question. Killing them, shooting them, it was the rule of thumb was one bullet for every Jew. Shooting them in the back of the head, burying them in these mass graves, it wasn't efficient enough. And they continued this search, this process of finding a more efficient way, basically, of dealing with or implementing the final solution. Hence the introduction later on of the gas chambers, which actually part of the T4 program in Germany, going back to the late 1930s. But in this situation, it made it more efficient because there you could kill hundreds of Jews in gas chambers over the course of 20, 25 minutes. It was a cleaner, a more efficient way, and I know it sounds pretty horrific to talk about it in such terms, but that's basically the way that the Germans saw this. So the earlier victims overall, overwhelmingly, these Soviet Jews who were the first major victims, they were shot. In the vast majority of cases, they were not gassed. When we think about the Holocaust by contemporary standards, we think more so from the stance of Treblinka and Auschwitz and Sobibor, etc., these killing centers located exclusively in Poland with the gas chambers. It was different for the Soviet Jews. And the significance is that you have these mass graves that remain, quite frankly, hidden up until recent, and that was due in large measure to the work of Father Patrick Dubois.
So unlike when Allied troops went into Germany and Poland and other places and liberated concentration camps, mm-hmm. these sites, these killing sites where people were shot, Jews were shot and put into these mass graves, were largely forgotten at the end of the war because people didn't know they were there.
That's to a very real extent that is true. What you have is the Soviets, in fact, had documented a good deal of this over the course of this time period. But you also have to understand that it's the time of the Stalinist era, and Joseph Stalin is ruling the nation. It's ultimately a police state, for use of a better word. And you have a case that communication was effectively curtailed. By the same token, the peasant population here in the Soviet Union, many of whom witnessed or certainly knew, if they didn't witness the executions of the Soviet Jews, they knew where the graves were, etc. They basically remained a bit disengaged because they were also concerned about getting into trouble, etc., etc. And so in this situation, it remained fairly fairly covered, quite frankly. However, with the formal fall of the Soviet Union a few decades ago, the Soviet archives were opened up. There's literally millions of pages of documents that were written in Russian that Father Dubois and his team have translated from the Russian. So it gives them really a rough roadmap as to where these mass graves are. And in some cases, they knew. For example, you have just outside of Kiev in a major city in Ukraine, in September of 1941, at a ravine known as Babi Yar, 33,771 Jews were summarily executed there over the course of just 2 days. So some of these cases, long before Father Dubois, were in fact documented, but the vast majority were not. And what has transitioned and what has transpired over the course of the past decade is there's more and more information in terms of archival sources that have come out in terms of a rough map as to where these graves are. And there's, up to this stage, I think there's 1,744 that have been uncovered. Some of them are fairly small, some of them are quite large. And in this sense, you also have a local population that is now aging. They were children during the Second World War, during the what the Soviets referred to as the Great Patriotic War. And they're more apt to talk and to discuss and to basically point where these different graves are, et cetera. And it's almost something of a, to get it off their chest, so to speak. And this has made the work in terms of the documentation for Father Dubois and his team all the easier.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Tim Crane. And he is one of those who is involved in researching and detecting with special equipment, which we'll find out more about, looking for the countless mass graves that are part of what is called the Hidden Holocaust, the killing of Jews early in World War II that was lost in many ways to history and is now being rediscovered. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Before I get into the tools, the methods that you are using to and others are using to help search for these mass graves, I'm just trying to understand a little more about what the Germans were doing. We certainly know what happened in countries that they overran, like Holland and France. What they did to the Jews there and the methods of extermination and the deporting of Jews to these death camps. But in a country like the Soviet Union, which the Germans invaded but did not overtake, I guess a lot of us are not aware of what the methods they used were. You're kind of explaining it now, but they didn't have a chance to get into these countries and really set up a system of extermination. So what you're saying is they just went into certain countries and just killed as many Jews as they could along with the soldiers they were fighting?
It was actually fairly organized. If you look, for example, when Nazi Germany initially invades the nation of Poland on September 1st, 1939, and World War II begins, there's more of a haphazard slaughter, so to speak, of the Jews that is taking place. And from the standpoint of the Germans, they're going to back off and they're going to, in essence, take the Jews of Poland, which was the largest Jewish population in Europe at that time, and force them all into ghettos, kind of more of a divide and conquer sort of an approach. Once you end up in the summer of 1941, with the onset of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, this is where the final solution is really going to be implemented. And it is indeed very organized on the part of the Germans. You have the army that is used, of course, against the Allies, the Wehrmacht, will be launching this massive advance in Operation Barbarossa, and attached to it will be the armies that will be used, in essence, for the mass murder of the European Jews, namely the SS and the Einsatzgruppen. So the Soviets, basically, the Soviet Jewish population resided overwhelmingly in the far western part of the country. And it would be a sense that the SS would descend upon them. They would be called into the center of the town or marketplace or whatever the case would be for relocation, marched out generally about 250 at a time out to these ravines, to these areas and heavy forested areas, et cetera, where in some cases ditches had already been dug, and they would be called, told to undress. They would be called forward 10 at a time on average and shot then in the back of the head. And once these actions were complete, then you would move on to the next town or hamlet, et cetera. So it was in the backdrop in terms of genocide in general or attempts at genocide, it becomes relatively easy to do if there's a war going on simultaneously. And we see this in countless examples over the course of the modern era. And such was also the case here with Germany as it's going to begin the Holocaust, and the first major victims are, in fact, these Soviet Jews.
Next week, the Seton Hill Center is showcasing many of the tools used in the search for commemoration of mass killing sites. What are these tools? How does this equipment help you find mass grave spots?
Well, what Father Dubois does basically, and it's a case that I would say probably the two greatest advantages that he has right now, and that his team has in fact had, is the he is able to have access to a great many archives. There's German archives, but more significantly, there's Soviet archives that would detail a rough map where some of this activity took place, where the mass graves in fact are. So this can be used as a guide. By the same token, what he will then do is he will go, this is going on now over the course of the more than a decade, he will go to these areas and he'll talk to the locals. And he's an individual who basically will just take in information. He's not judgmental. He's just getting as much information from them as possible. And in essence, where they were, how they are tied in some cases, some of these families now, decades later, of course, knew the families, the Jewish families in the Soviet Union who were, in fact, murdered by the Germans. And they will take him, in many cases, to these grave sites. The rule of thumb for the Germans was one bullet for every Jew. And if you're, they would be shot, the system was always the same in the back of the head, because if you hit at the base of your skull, there's really no chance of survival, because that part of your brain, of course, is going to control your heart and your lungs, et cetera. And what he can do with some of his equipment is he basically can tell in terms of shell casings, et cetera, in these areas. He cannot disturb the graves. From the standpoint of the Jewish community, they do not want any of the graves disturbed. But they are all there, and this is a standing memorial, unlike the countless millions of victims here, of Jewish victims who were gassed in these killing centers in Poland, who also were burned. These corpses, in fact, remain. In essence, therefore, you have the foundation, which undermines, in essence, Holocaust denial. And as a modern Jewish historian who's also Roman Catholic, to even have to address that issue is a bit absurd. It's about the equivalency of saying World War II never happened for those people who deny the Holocaust. But having said that, you end up with a case that this is his standing testimony. This is going to be the memorial at the end of the day towards this, because you have what right at this stage is about 1.5 million corpses. Eventually, the belief is that he'll get up to about 2.3 million in the former Soviet Union, in places like Soviet republics of Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, etc.
How do people react when they are asked to tell their stories about what they saw during the Nazi invasion?
It's a situation that they're a bit taken aback, quite frankly, in many cases, and some people really don't want to discuss this with Father Dubois, and they're simply not comfortable. But
taken aback in what way?
Well, taken aback that they're not comfortable discussing, because in some situations you have a scenario that, although they weren't involved, they weren't perpetrators, they were kids. In some cases, they were actually watching the killings. It became something resembling that of a public spectacle. And the process there was very, very troubling for these people who witnessed this, these non-Jews in the Soviet Union who witnessed the mass murders. And it was something that they weren't overly well over by any stretch of the means comfortable talking about. However,
is there a certain level of guilt there? Because, you know, not that the Soviets were collaborators here, but the Soviet Union, by and large, based on its history, was no friend of the Jews.
Absolutely. In fact, I would go so far as to say that in terms of the two nations in the world in the modern era that have the worst track record regarding anti-Semitism, I would say is Poland and the former Soviet Union. So certainly, and you also see a direct correlation throughout this final solution that wherever Germany received the support of the local population, the death toll was also significantly higher than if the local population did not, in fact, go along with it. Classic example of that is you have an unbelievably high death rate of Soviet Jews. You have an unbelievably high rate of Polish Jews during the Second World War here in the backdrop of the final solution. But if you look at other countries like Italy, France, it's a little bit lower. And the question then was, is it a case that the French and the Italians were appalled, or it's because they didn't want the Germans telling them what to do? It remains open for debate in the present day. But you do see this correlation. So when the local population cooperated and participated, quite frankly, as perpetrators in many situations, the death toll was always significantly higher. And I think that certainly contributed to it. There's
so part
no
of
doubt.
The part of the being taken aback is not so much it is as much about not wanting to relive a bad memory as it is guilt that, you know, even if you're a child, you're standing by and you're watching this and nobody did anything to stop it.
Absolutely. And by the same token, you may also have been a perpetrator. So there's that gray area, so to speak. And it to go back to, in the words of the great historian Raoul Hilberg, for as long as a group of people are not fully accepted into a society, they walk a tightrope between acceptance and annihilation. And Adolf Hitler's Germany, a supposedly civilized and cultured nation, a nation of Bach and Beethoven, surrendered its will to this charismatic dictator and came closer than human beings have ever come to creating hell on earth.
We have a tweet from Nettie who says, how and where will these people be properly interned or buried? How many have been uncovered and how many do you think are still out there?
There's right now about approximately 1.5 million have been uncovered in the former Soviet Union. It's estimated that there's about 2.3 million. So the work here of Father Dubois goes on. The graves will not be disturbed. It is something that the Jewish community is completely opposed to. They will remain here as the standing memorial. I mean, it's a sense that on his first trip for Patrick Dubois, his first trip, he was taken aback because he knew in this area where his grandfather, who had been held as a prisoner of war, was in fact a prison camp nearby, that he knew there had been mass killings there, but there was no memorial, there was no nothing to in fact mark this spot. And this is really one of the major things that got him going along this road towards basically becoming in essence a voice for these people.
And how are you working to build relationships between the universities and Jewish communities?
Well, from the standpoint of our National Catholic Center for Holocaust Education, which was established in 1987, our focus primarily is on Holocaust education, but it is also in terms of bridge building between Jewish communities and Catholic communities. And with the transition that has gone on in the aftermath, quite frankly, the relationship between Jews and Christians has not been good. And I'm speaking again, not only just as a modern Jewish historian, but as a Catholic. We have a very poor track record, what's oftentimes referred to as the longest hatred of 2,000 years.
Why is that?
Well, I would say that it goes back to the concept of Christianity blaming the sister religion of Judaism for the death of Jesus of Nazareth, quite frankly, the Jews as Christ killers. And it became, as the centuries progressed, the Jews as ritual murderers, the Jews as everything you did not want yourself to be. And it's something that old bigotries die a very, very slow death. And what happens is you take this framework of Christian anti-Judaism And it becomes applied to the modern era. It becomes applied here to modern anti-Semitism of the Jews and their unbelievable power, which, of course, is also ridiculous. It's absurd, but of remains prominent in the world today, especially in Europe, but in other areas too. And so you have this transition, this transformation. But I would argue that of a silver lining of this horrific, unbelievably horrible event to the backdrop of the Second World War is you have a wake-up call, quite frankly, for my own church, the Roman Catholic Church, which saw the dangers here of intolerance of these 2,000 years. It's not just Christian anti-Judaism. Germany has to lose World War I for there to be a Holocaust. And finally, Adolf Hitler also has to be added to the mix. But those conditions had to, in fact, formally be there. And what happens in the aftermath of the Second World War is you have this transition, this transformation. And going back to, it's in fact the 50th anniversary this month of Nostra Aetate, literal translation of In Our Time, coming forth from the Second Vatican Council that had been started here, called together by Pope John the 23rd, that stressed the Jews living or at the time of Jesus had nothing to do with his death. And it's a very tragic and a very sad state of affairs that this carried on for 2,000 years, because we should have been as Christians, the greatest protector of our sister religion of Judaism. And not only did we fail to protect Judaism, at times we became its greatest persecutor. I would argue that that's something that Christianity, though tremendous strides have been made over the past 50 years and continue to be made, it is something that Christianity in the present is still trying to come to grips with.
We've been talking with Tim Crane, who is the director of the National Catholic Center for Holocaust Education at Seton Hill University. They're holding a conference next week designed to explore the untold stories of Jews killed and buried in mass graves throughout the Soviet Union during World War II. I wish you the best of luck in your work, and thank you for a fascinating conversation. It's been very enlightening.
Thank you so much, and it would be wonderful if your listeners would be interested. The tickets are free for Father Dubois on this coming Sunday, October 25th, at the Performing Arts Center on Seton Hill University's campus. They can go online to setonhill.edu/tickets and free of charge, but you do have to have a ticket for admission for the 7:30 presentation. I definitely would recommend it, and it would be great to see you there. And thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. It sounds like it would be time well spent. Tim Crane, again, great thanks. Coming up, City Councilman Dan Gilman joins us to talk about how his ethics and finance proposals will create more transparency in city government and municipal elections. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.